lodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bass to the playhouse of fortune.
To be fair to the advocates of happiness psychology or human flourishing, they have a definition of the good life. And it does involve being involved with others, and it does involve expanding your mind. It's not simply a mindless optimism. However, it still has this whole overlay of nothing should really throw you off your path. You should be resilient. And the fact of the matter is that we're faced with problems like global warming, that if we don't get knocked off our path, we're not going to address them. To be resilient runs the risk of making people not able to care enough to change what they're doing. And when it comes to specifically DSM, we're all enthralled to this idea that suffering is the result of something that medicine can treat. That's an idea we come by honestly because medicine has figured out how to treat an awful lot of suffering. But the idea that all our suffering can be found in biological pathologies that can be targeted with magic bullet drugs and treated, that's ultimately a very oppressive idea, and it's a very limited idea.
Soon like lightning, we soon will be riding my shiny black bass. No,
you're listening to episode 683 of Unwelcome Guests, the standardization of mind and body. I'm Robin Upton, and we've just heard Gary Greenberg, author of The Book of Woe, The DSM and the Unmaking of Society, with what I think is more or less the core of his message, warning of the dangers of putting what is effectively a private corporation in charge of the definitions of mental health. We're going to be coming back to that later on in the show. Now, last time, Shadows of Liberty, we looked at how the emerging communications technologies of the 20th century were swiftly assimilated into the establishment, formed into hierarchies associated with licenses and companies for profit motives to build the big media machine of today, what is effectively the propaganda arm of what David Graeber refers to as the vast machine. Now, this time we're taking another angle on the vast machine, looking at public perceptions of health, disability, mental health, and how they help to buttress the workings of the vast machine. As our first speaker points out, disability, being disabled, generally defined with respect to ability to take part in the capitalist means of production, as if that were the main yardstick against which everything should be measured. Now, isn't it strange, in a country devoted to pursuit of happiness, how depression seems to have become endemic, notwithstanding unprecedented amounts of pharmaceutical interventions at an ever younger age? Now, we're going to be ending this week, as I like to do, on a positive note. We're going to be returning to the ideas of Tony Wright, that human brain chemistry has become more and more dysfunctional over the last few millennia because of changes in diet. But we start the show with a talk from 2013 by Jess Martin. Thank you to We Are Many for this talk entitled A History of Disability Rights Activism. And if you'd like to get more in a similar vein, you can download them from wearemany.org.
So welcome everyone to the first session in our Disability Talk extravaganza. I hope you're as excited as I am. The World Health Organization reports that more than 1 billion people, roughly 1 in 7 of the world's population, are disabled. And almost 80% of all of us will experience either temporary or permanent disability through the course of our lives. As with all awfulness under capitalism, disablement happens disproportionately to women, people of color, and the elderly. We know, of course, that poverty increases the likelihood of impairment, whether it's due to chronic diseases such as heart disease, diabetes and arthritis, occupational injuries, or preventable infectious disease in the global south, like tuberculosis, HIV/AIDS, malaria, congenital defects, etc. We also know that disability further accelerates poverty. In the United States, working-age disabled folks are twice as likely to be unemployed as non-disabled. And in the United States, 44% of workers with disabilities are in contingent or part-time jobs, compared to 22% of the non-disabled. These high rates of unemployment and underemployment mean reliance upon social wage programs such as Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, which require navigating a tangle of bureaucracy to obtain, and in the case of Social Security disability insurance, routinely require the assistance of a lawyer in order to obtain poverty-level benefits. All of these limited social programs are now currently being slashed and burned in the bipartisan austerity onslaught. Disabled individuals are also exceedingly vulnerable to abuse and violence. 1 in 8 victims of police murder in 2012 was mentally ill or in severe mental distress. Just last week, an Oregon police officer tased an 11-year-old autistic girl walking on the street because she did not verbally respond when he spoke to her. Families who murder their disabled children, and there are a number of these cases, generally get off with few or no penalties in the court system. And although much legislation has been passed to ensure the civil rights and protections of persons with disabilities, as with all civil rights law, the only mechanism for enforcement is via long and arduous lawsuit, which puts the burden on the disabled person and their family to fight to obtain their rights. So, how did we get here? I'd like to briefly sketch out a few historical factors in the development of disability as a social category, which has given rise to these dire circumstances, and also to discuss a little bit about the reform movements and the activism that led up to the disability rights movement in the 20th century. So I'm going to start with the colonial period. In the colonial period, physical impairments were common, and they were generally unremarked upon. Missing eyes, missing limbs did not prevent participation in agriculture and small-scale production. And so people with these impairments were not disabled from working in an environment where production was more flexible. Extended families provided support, care, and assistance in adapting labor conditions. In comparison with physical impairments, mental illness and mental impairments attracted much more attention, but only those people who were really violent in their behavior were sent to jails or workhouses. In the late 1700s, almshouses and workhouses began to appear to warehouse those who were economically dependent. Those sent to workhouses were routinely treated to lashings and physical abuse as a form of treatment, and those who were least capable of working were thrown into crazy cellars. Asylums and educational institutions for various disabilities began to appear in the early 1800s. A new mode of treatment, called moral treatment, recommended that madmen and lunatics be treated with some sensitivity. No restraints, no physical punishment, no bloodletting. A philosophy of rational, kindly care and withdrawal from the world was said to help the distressed regain their reason. In the first decades of the 19th century, Samuel Gridley Howe establishes the Perkins School of the Blind, and Thomas Hopkins Gallaudet founds the Hartford Asylum for the Deaf. And so these are the first institutions that start catering in terms of education for disabled populations. But of course, as with many things, they catered mostly to male members of upper-class white families. At the time, women, blacks, and Native Americans were all considered simply by virtue of their biological being to be innately disabled to one degree or another. It was held that women should not be educated, lest it inspire them to insanity or hysteria. Blacks, of course, as part of the rationale for slavery, were held to be racially, mentally inferior and incapable of anything beyond manual labor. Native Americans, of course, as part of the justification for colonialism, were considered mentally inferior and in many cases incapable of civilized language. With the acceleration of industrial capitalism as the dominant mode of production, bodies became increasingly valued for their ability to function like machines. Those with non-standard bodies were excluded by the standardization and the rapid repetition of factory work. And this created issues of unemployment and economic marginalization. And this is why we talk about disability as being socially constructed, right? Because people with impairments were able to work and be productive in the community before that. Factories also greatly increase the risk of accidental impairment by powerful machinery and hazardous chemicals. Extraction of mined resources led to epidemics of silicosis and black lung, and the crowded unsanitary conditions in the rapidly growing cities led to more diseases, which killed large numbers, but also left disabled survivors. The dissolution of extended family networks, as people were drawn into waged employment, left people with impairments with no social support, and the economic necessity to work for a wage meant that those who were previously capable of contributing labor were disabled by the conditions of production and the demands of industrial capital. With an increase in the demand for literacy, also, this number of impairments also increases, because folks who had mild intellectual or developmental issues wouldn't have even been recognized prior to this point because they were working in agriculture or craft production, and now they start to be excluded from certain types of work. The horrors of the transatlantic passage, the brutality and forced labor, and the poor living conditions of slavery enacted a tremendous physical cost in terms of the impairment and disability of black bodies. Disabled slaves were termed as refuse slaves, and they were resold at low prices or they were abandoned. Native Americans also suffered from European diseases and violence, which killed or impaired millions of people. So you start to see, you know, increasing numbers of impaired people. In the mid-1840s, the number of asylums and institutions expands rapidly. Progressive reformer Dorothea Dix conducts a high-profile campaign exposing the abuses of the mentally ill in the prison system, leading to public funding in a number of northern states for insane asylums. Legislation at this time first provides legal definitions of the insane and imbeciles to differentiate them from the general prison and workhouse populations. Around the same time, Samuel Gridley Howe opens a facility for intellectually impaired children, then known as idiots, as an add-on facility at the Perkins School of the Blind. So we start to see the labeling and the medicalization of disability at this point. So impairments are seen as treatable, curable, or fixable. Disabled persons are the objects of pity and charity. In this period prior to the Civil War, these asylums were seen as cutting-edge treatment. They're providing education, rehabilitation, and also some employment in what were known as sheltered workshops, which were intended to teach vocational skills that disabled people could then hopefully translate into employment in the community, which, as we discover later, doesn't actually pan out. Institutionalization as a social response to exclusion from labor was and continues to be a tremendously significant structural factor for disabled folks throughout the 20th century. The various wars of the 19th and 20th century would also have a tremendous impact on the disabled population. Huge influxes of newly disabled people, medical and surgical innovations from battlefield medicine, and the increased production of prosthetic and mobility technology would arise in the periods of these bursts of technological innovation, the periods coming right after the Civil War, right after the World War I, and right after World War II. Disabled soldiers were first provided medical and rehabilitative care after the Civil War. Congress passed a pension program for Union Army veterans with disabilities. The program required eligibility screening based on medical evaluation, and disability was defined as an inability to work. With this legislation, the medical model of disability becomes enshrined in law, and this hallowed tradition of bureaucracy, gatekeeping, and the denial of resources to the disabled. The Civil War exacerbated the social and legal hierarchy between military disabled and civilian disabled, with a disparity in access to resources. I'm going to jump ahead here a little bit. The demand for labor in the World Wars meant an increasing employment of the disabled at home when non-disabled workers went abroad to fight, with significant increases in the Second World War. Goodyear and Firestone hired deaf workers for their Akron, Ohio plants during World War I. They provided sports facilities, dance halls, and social clubs for the deaf community. Their experience was so positive that the two companies continued to recruit deaf workers even after the war. Unfortunately, this was happening only in small pockets during World War I. During World War II, close to 200,000 disabled workers found jobs. The War Manpower Commission conducted a major media campaign to educate the public on the capabilities of disabled workers in an effort to remove social stigma. This situation points out the social construction of disability. When capital has no need for reserve labor, people with impairments are excluded from working. Discrimination based on the profit motive is the key barrier to employment, not any functional limitation on the part of the individual. When capitalism has a use for impaired bodies, it finds accommodation, especially when it's in the service of mass murder. In the immediate aftermath of World War II, there were tremendous developments in prosthetics and wheelchair technology, investigations into stainless steel, titanium, etc. And another situation that spurred further development in terms of assistive technology and mobility technology were the polio epidemics, which happened every year basically from 1916 through the 1950s. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, himself a polio survivor, founded the Georgia Warm Springs Foundation and the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis, and these institutions collected tremendous amounts of money to improve the iron lung, which helped polio victims survive, and also to develop new, lighter, more portable ventilators, wheelchairs, and braces. They also put a bunch of money into the vaccines. The huge numbers left disabled by polio altered the image and status of disabled people, and a number of leaders of the early disability rights movement were polio survivors. So these are some of the big picture factors. I'd like to talk a little bit about the sort of seeds of organizational consciousness and the sort of awareness of the necessity to fight back within disabled communities at the end of the 19th century. The deaf-mute newspaper appears in 1849. The silent worker newspaper appears in 1888. Both of these served deaf communities. So we start to see print media coming out for these communities. The residents of the Utica State Lunatic Asylum published a journal called The Opal from 1851 to 1860, which then became the inspiration later on for the anti-psychiatry and parts of the deinstitutionalization movement later on. They were an early liberation movement for mentally ill patients. They were writing very interesting things at the time. Louis Braille had invented his print for the blind in 1829. But we also see at this time this increase in the number of social organizations and institutions for the disabled because they're obtaining increasing levels of education and vocational training. In 1864, Congress legislated the creation of Gallaudet University after significant lobbying efforts by Edward Minor Gallaudet, son of Thomas. You start to see organizations such as the New York Blind Aid Association, the American Blind People's Higher Education and Improvement Association, the American Professional Society of the Deaf, and in particular, the organizations for the deaf form part of the context for a really important controversy around the issue of oralism. In the 1840s, hearing educators for the deaf began to advocate for the elimination of sign language, which had previously been the dominant mode of instruction for deaf people. Oralism was the belief that the deaf can and should communicate exclusively by lip reading and speech. They believed that sign language impeded the social integration of the deaf and that the deaf population was resisting assimilation. This was occurring at a time when the American economy was expanding with a growing industrial sector. There were large waves of immigration and labor competition, which were spurring sharp racial and economic conflicts, and the upper classes really feared ethnic and linguistic diversity. So the accusations toward the immigrant communities and toward the deaf community of resisting assimilation were cast in the same language. The clubs and associations and schools that were dedicated for the deaf community mirrored those of the non-white ethnic groups, excluding white people. Social Darwinism at this point, you know, had a great appeal to rationalize and explain why social inequity was a natural phenomenon, and biology was, of course, misused to argue that heredity in terms of race and genes would prevail over class and economic issues. So this spurred fears over disabled reproduction, and it was used as a continuing justification for the segregation, the warehousing, and the discrimination against disabled people. In this context, oralists warned that the deaf would become foreigners among their own countrymen, and no gesturer can become an American. So part of the fight back against this was the National Association of the Deaf. They organized in 1880. They defended sign language as the natural language of the deaf. They argued that eliminating ASL would be educationally disastrous, which it was. And they also lobbied against eugenics and defended the rights of the deaf to marry, have children, and share full citizen status. But the horrors of social Darwinism and eugenics were only just beginning to unfold. In 1909, Indiana passed a law for the compulsory eugenic sterilization of convicted criminals and the mentally impaired. And we start to see these acts come up. In 1914, Harry Laughlin, superintendent of an organization known as the Eugenics Record Office, drafted the Model Sterilization Act, which were then used in the Virginia law in 1924, and most notably in Nazi Germany in 1933. The language of Laughlin's act was taken almost wholesale and used by the Nazis in the law for the protection against genetically defective offspring. It covered 9 supposedly hereditary conditions. Over the course of time, in Germany, it was used to sterilize 400,000 people. Globally, it was used to sterilize 15 million people. And in the United States, from 1920 to 1970, laws based on these same ideas sterilized 65,000 people. And that's something we don't hear about a lot, you know, the United States piece of that. You know, maybe we'll hear about things like the Tuskegee experiments, right? But you don't hear about the wholesale sterilization of the mentally impaired in the United States in the 20th century. Some states still to this day permit sterilization of the mentally impaired without their consent, either under court or family agreement. So the strong presumption remains that disability disqualifies one from parenting.
And if you're interested in the hidden history of eugenics in the USA, you might wish to check out episode 613 on the economic disposal of the worthless. Now, this concept of disability, that label in particular, is something that it's been hard for me not to think about. My wife would be labelled as disabled by anybody going around with a labelling gun. I don't think of her as disabled at all. That's just not how things work. And the realities of people who are referred to as disabled, their lives, depend very much, I think, on if the sort of social matrix in which they find themselves. Are they surrounded by people who, quite possibly with the best intentions, but under the tutelage of the vast machine, are sorry for them because they're not able to function properly in the capitalist system? Or have they found positive relationships in which they can flourish, unhindered or even helped by the differences deemed by the capitalist orthodoxy to make them dysfunctional? As an outstanding example of what the so-called disabled can achieve, we get to hear the following short testimony by Anne Sullivan, who, visually impaired and at the age of 20, took on a task that she was to excel at, teaching Helen Keller, later to become political activist and co-founder of the American Civil Liberties Union.
When I saw Helen Keller first, she was 6 years and 8 months old. She had been blind and deaf and mute since her 19th month as the result of an illness. She had no way of communicating with those around her except a few imitative signs that she had made for herself. A push meant go and a pull meant come and so on. She had observed that we did not use the hands when we were talking to each other. And I let her see by putting her hand on my face how we talked with our mouths. She felt the vibration of the spoken word. Instantly, she spelled, "I want to talk with my mouth." That seemed impossible. But after experimenting for a time, we found that placing her hand in this position, the thumb resting on the throat, right at the larynx, the first finger on the lips, the second on the nose, we found that she could feel the vibration of spoken words. For instance, the throat, she feels the G, the hard G, G. And on the lips, she feels the, and the K sound, K, K. On the lips, she feels the B and the T, and the, with the second finger on the nose, the nasal sounds, the N, the M. The first word she learned to articulate was the little word it. With the hand in this position, I made the vowel I. She felt it. I. Then I made the T. She feels it with the finger on her lip, on my lips. Then I put the two letters together to form the word it. And the first word was learned. After her seventh lesson, she was able to speak the sentence word by word. I am not dumb now.
I find myself perpetually moved to tears by that recording in ways that I can't properly understand. Whether it was the faith of somebody partially blind, only 20 years old, who nevertheless had the faith and the courage to say, yes, we're going to try our best to help this deaf and blind girl to speak. Something that was pretty unprecedented, but which turned out to be possible after only 7 lessons. I'm reminded of the time when I saw somebody learn to write. When inside of an hour, somebody went from not being able to write to being able to write intelligibly. That was thanks to a physiotherapist who had the confidence to believe somebody who'd suffered a spinal injury and who'd never tried to write again would nevertheless be able to write. Whatever it's like to grow up deaf and blind, we can be pretty sure there's some fundamental differences to growing up with normal hearing and sight. So in that sense, I can't perhaps be so surprised that on the occasions when I've communicated with deaf-blind people using active sign language, then I've found it always to be very, very moving emotional experience, a connection with them. And the fact that people recognize me, although they're deaf and blind, it doesn't, to my logical left brain, make any kind of sense. I don't know what to do with it. But I found the deaf-blind have a remarkable ability to touch me emotionally. I wonder, perhaps I should get in touch with Tony Wright, drop him an email about that same thought. Now, our next recording from June 2013 is an interview by Gary Hall of Madness Radio with Gary Greenberg, from whom we heard a few remarks at the very start of the show.
Today my guest is Gary Greenberg. Gary is a therapist and author. He is a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine. He's written for The Rolling Stone, New Yorker, New York Times, and he's also the author of Manufacturing Depression. His new book is called The Book of Woe, The DSM and the Unmaking of Psychiatry. So welcome to Madness Radio, Gary Greenberg.
Well, hi, it's good to be here.
It's really good to have you here. And Gary, you were actually interviewed a few years ago before the Manufacturing Depression book came out. And so if people want to check out that interview archived at the Madness Radio website, I encourage people to do that. Well, you went pretty far down the rabbit hole of the DSM. How did you, because, I mean, your work is getting, I mean, it's great to see your work is really getting out there. Manufacturing Depression is a great book, and you've been getting a lot of coverage, a lot of mainstream media play. And how did you end up writing the book that is really encapsulating where the DSM struggle for the DSM-5 is, the Book of Woe? How did you end up writing that book?
The easy answer to that question is that I wrote a magazine article for Wired about the DSM about 3 years ago, when the wars that the psychiatrists were fighting over the DSM-5 were just beginning to heat up. That article was called The Book of Woe, just like my book is, and the editor who assigned it was a guy from Harper's, and Harper's was a magazine in which I had an article that became the book about depression, Manufacturing Depression. And in that article, I spent some time at Harvard Medical School as a subject in a clinical trial. I was guinea pigging it. And thankfully, my clinical trial did not involve real psychotropic drugs. It involved fish oil. And actually, as it turned out, I was on the placebo anyway. In any event, the surprising part of that trial to me was that I originally signed up for a trial of minor depression. But the intake interview conducted by a psychiatrist, in the intake interview, he concluded that I had major depression. And not that I'd ever been a big fan of the DSM. As a clinician, I've been using it forever. And always thought it's like a colonoscopy. It's one of those unpleasant things you have to put yourself through in the case of the DSM in order to help people use their insurance to pay for therapy. But as I was getting interviewed by this doctor, I realized he was asking me questions keyed to the criteria in the DSM, but he wasn't really paying any attention to me. And not only did I find that personally insulting, but as a clinician, I wondered, how can you do this? How can you simply attend to the criteria and not attend to the patient?
How did he do that exactly, Gary? What was it he was doing?
He gave me a test called the SCID. And the SCID is a diagnostic inventory keyed to the DSM criteria. And it's very simple. Like the major criterion for depression is, for major depressive disorder, is sadness that lasts for 2 weeks, at least 2 weeks. So the question that's keyed to that is, have you been sad for 2 weeks? It's not rocket science. It is a checkbox. It's a troubleshooting chart. They go down, and if you answer no, then they skip to page 26. And if you answer yes, then they go to the next item. And it covers, the full SCID covers the entire DSM. And theoretically, if you spend the hour with the person doing it, you can come out with a DSM diagnosis. So he was paying more attention to the paperwork than he was to me. And in the end, he concluded that I had major depressive disorder. Now, this was a very strange thing because I had gotten myself the 90 miles to Boston. I had shown up. I was my usual charming, funny self. I was clear that I was there partly as a to do research myself, that is, to write an article about this. I was engaging. I wasn't somebody that if I was in his chair, I would have thought had major depressive disorder. But according to the DSM, at least according to the tests he was giving me keyed to the DSM, I did have major depressive disorder. And that sort of focused my interest on how this book actually got put together and how it's used, remembering that the DSM, it's not only a convenience for therapists and people who want to use their insurance, it determines what drugs get approved. It determines courtroom questions like whether or not somebody is incompetent to stand trial. It determines commitments, and that is to say the kind that have to do with mental health. It's used in school districts to determine who's eligible for special services. It's a hugely important book. And so the question of how it gets put together and who puts it together and what their interests are is more than just of, you know, some kind of scholarly value. It's a question of public health and public policy.
You describe the DSM as to psychiatrists what the Bible is to Christians.
It was not my idea to call the DSM the Bible of psychiatry, and it's actually in some ways true. It's true in the sense that it's the foundational text. It's true in the sense that it's also like the Constitution is to the United States. It's the book that gives the institution its authority. Unlike the Constitution and unlike the Bible, the authority of the DSM comes not from God and not from, you know, the founding fathers. It comes from, at least presumably, from science. The modern DSM was psychiatry's attempt to rescue itself from a terrible crisis, which they found themselves embedded in the beginning of the 1970s. And so sort of consciously created it as the cornerstone of the profession.
So what was that crisis? Was that kind of the transition from Freudian psychoanalysis and that kind of approach to psychological problems and treatment to a more clinical or more scientific claiming approach? Is that what it was?
The crisis in psychiatry was caused in part by some embarrassing studies that showed that psychiatrists, given the same patient, would disagree about what mental illness they had more often than they would agree. So that was one problem. And that was sort of an in-house problem that bothered psychiatrists. But then David Rosenhan did his famous On Being Sane in Insane Places, which was the study showing that, you know, in which graduate students showed up at emergency rooms complaining that they were hearing the word thud in their heads and were promptly admitted, all of them, to different hospitals with diagnoses of schizophrenia. And in some cases had trouble getting back out of the hospital, even though they never did anything more to indicate mental illness. And that study made a big splash. And then in 1973, after years of protest by activists, the APA, American Psychiatric Association, voted to delete homosexuality from the DSM, which was then in its second edition, which was troublesome in many ways, the most obvious of which is, can you really vote a diagnosis off the island? Is that science? So psychiatry was not for the first time in its existence under siege, largely because of these questions of what is a mental illness and which mental illnesses exist and how do you know them and so on. And so they had to come up with a way to diagnose people reliably. And so during the 1970s, under the guidance of Robert Spitzer, they learned how to fashion criteria to go along with mental illnesses. So suddenly, instead of a paragraph describing what a mental illness, what, say, major depression or schizophrenia was, suddenly there were 9 criteria for depression, and I think it's 6 criteria for schizophrenia, and so on. If they did, and their troubles were considered to be clinically significant, then they were said to qualify. They were said to meet the criteria, which was to say they had the disorder. That was the DSM-3, and that was how this approach to diagnosis came about in the first place. Since 1980, there have been a number of revisions of the DSM, and every time they revise it, there's new fights. And if you look at it from the if you just ask the question, did it work? The answer is it worked brilliantly. Psychiatry went from being a backwater and held in disregard by many doctors and other specialties, came back toward the mainstream. In addition, it regained the confidence of important funding sources like insurance companies and government, the National Institute of Health, all by virtue of having been able to claim that they had made diagnosis reliable. What they hadn't done, and this is really important, is they had shown that doctors could agree that this group of symptoms added up to that disorder, but they hadn't proved that the disorders existed. So while they had shown that the diagnoses were reliable, that they could be agreed upon, they hadn't shown that they were diagnoses of anything.
So when the in the clinical trial, the doctor is asking you, have you been sad? Have you had these feelings? Have you had these thoughts? And comes up with this idea that you're, you know, have clinically depressed. It doesn't really mean anything for you personally. It's just a sort of observation from the outside.
It actually meant surprisingly a lot to me. Because even though I was very skeptical already, I mean, I've been years in this field, and this wasn't the first time I'd written about psychiatry. It certainly wasn't the first project in which I'd wondered about the disorders. It still had an effect on me to be told, you know, you qualify for this disorder. And at that time, this was 2007, the idea that depression in particular was the chemical imbalance had really taken hold. So even though I was very skeptical of that, I started wondering, well, I wonder if I do have a chemical imbalance, because I do struggle with moodiness. And I mean, ask my wife, she'll tell you. I can be pretty moody. I can get pretty low. And, you know, suddenly I'm wondering at the age of whatever I was at the time, 50, have I lived my life with an unnecessary amount of suffering because there's something wrong with my brain?
That's a huge, huge question that people face. Is this something that, you know, could have been treated, should be treated, because it's a physical limitation that I have? And I think that is an appeal to taking psychiatric medications or getting that test and getting that diagnosis. What do you think about that now? Did you take a look at that, about the biochemical, the claim that there's a biochemical basis, that there's an imbalance, that there are people who actually have disordered brains, and it's only right and only human to give them medical treatment for this medical physical disorder that they have?
Well, what I would say about that is that there's no doubt that the brain, like any other organ in the body, can go bad. I mean, why wouldn't it be able to, right? It's the most complicated organ in the body. You might even say it's more likely to go bad. But that, I don't believe that that accounts for all of the suffering. There are many ways that a person can come to feel depressed, and one of them may have to do with brain pathology. But the problem is that at the moment, anyway, psychiatry can't distinguish between those disorders that are caused, or people with the disorders whose trouble is caused by something going on in their brain that's analogous to, I don't know, diabetes or cancer or something like that, and people whose suffering simply resembles the organic pathology. But what they do is they simply gloss over that possible distinction, One of the things that the DSM-3 did and continues right through DSM-5 is it just said, we're not going to say anything about, the psychiatrist wrote it, said, we're not going to say anything about what causes these disorders or what the nature of them is. We're simply going to say, these are the symptoms, and if you have the symptoms and they're clinically significant, then you have the disorder. They've washed their hands of the whole question, which on the one hand, you understand that makes some sense, and at the same time, it's ridiculous. Because what it means is that anybody with those symptoms has this disorder, and the assumption behind all of this, whether it's stated or not, is that these are brain disorders, and someday we'll find out exactly what's wrong with the brain that's making you be this way. So you ask the question of, what was my investigation of this question? So I did a lot of research into the question of, where did this idea of depression as a biochemical imbalance come from? And what I discovered was that it's a myth. It's a very carefully constructed myth. And I'm not trying to say there's a conspiracy here. It's just that doctors are so bound and determined to find organic pathology, biochemical imbalances behind depression, that they just assume it's there and therefore they see it.
You're also not saying that the experience of suffering or of pain is a myth. You're saying that the claim that there's a biological cause and a chemical imbalance, that's the myth.
Yeah, I mean, look, obviously anything that happens that has to do with consciousness is impossible without certain biochemical events. It would be crazy or something like crazy to say otherwise. It would be like insisting that the sun circles the earth, you know? But what does that mean exactly? Is the brain event the necessary and sufficient condition for the suffering? I'm not sure. I know it's the necessary condition. But, you know, maybe the brain is serving something else. Maybe there's such a thing as a mind. So, yeah, I'm not saying that the brain events don't exist or that they're not important. I'm just saying that they're not the only thing that we should be looking at. And more important, we don't know what those brain events are, even though at this moment you and I are talking. I guarantee you, somewhere in some doctor's office, somewhere in this country, a doctor is telling a patient that they have a chemical imbalance in their brain and that that's why they should take their Abilify, or that's why they should take Prozac. And that very same doctor, if he goes to a medical conference, will certainly talk to his, if a colleague asks him, hey, what about that chemical imbalance? He's going to say, well, no, there isn't. We don't know if there's a chemical imbalance because they don't. The idea that serotonin deficiencies cause depression, which comes from the fact that the drugs affect serotonin metabolism, is absolutely incorrect. Everybody knows that. It's not serotonin deficiencies. It may not even be serotonin metabolism. It may be what happens as a result of altering serotonin metabolism in the brain that creates the effect of antidepressants. Mm-hmm. The brain's way too complicated for these simplistic explanations.
And I think the other claim of that is that, well, you know, the antidepressant drugs work because they correct chemical imbalances. There's this disease or this disorder or these levels of chemicals are off balance, and that's how the drugs work. Well, actually, you can't demonstrate that chemically either. That's not why do some people find medications useful, for example.
Yes, and exactly. And indeed, if that were the case, you would expect a much more robust effect of these drugs. They aren't very effective, and it's been very difficult for the drug companies to prove efficacy in clinical trials. So yeah, clearly that's a myth, and that's a lot of what manufacturing depression is about.
Because I think that when we talk about this question of, well, do these biological diseases, disorders actually exist, people tend to think that, well, we're claiming that suffering isn't real or that people don't need help on the one hand, but it's not at all. I mean, extreme human suffering can certainly exist without it saying that it's a biological cause or that it can be simply explained away by a chemical imbalance. And I think the other thing that happens is that people think, well, you're claiming that medications aren't helpful to people. Well, actually, clearly, obviously, many, many people take medications and find them and experience them as helpful. Many people don't have the opposite experience. But that doesn't mean that the explanation for why it's helpful can be reduced to this biological point of view or biological causality.
I talk a lot about pediatric bipolar because that's probably the biggest psychiatric scandal of our generation, you know, recent years, which actually has not that much to do with the DSM except for one thing. The DSM gives clinicians so much flexibility in terms of diagnosing mental illness that it was possible, despite the fact that if you look at the criteria for bipolar disorder, It's virtually impossible to diagnose a child with bipolar disorder. It doesn't say you can't, but it's very difficult to justify that diagnosis because bipolar disorder requires episodic mania. And children, most of them haven't lived long enough to have episodic mania. And it's very rarely observed in children. That's why prior to the advent of this idea about pediatric bipolar, there was so little of it. But the DSM offers you this incredibly generous loophole called NOS, not otherwise specified. And so there is a diagnosis called bipolar disorder, NOS. And that's what children were diagnosed with. So one of the things that psychiatrists are surprisingly, apparently uninformed about, or at least aren't aware of, is that the effect that a diagnosis has on people's identity. Psychiatrists are very good at understanding the problem of stigma. And they have, to their credit, tried to do things to make stigma less. They've done advocacy and so on. They work with various groups to try to make that burden of diagnosis reduced. But they don't seem to understand that when you get a diagnosis, particularly of a lifelong disorder like bipolar disorder, that it changes the way you think about yourself. It becomes your identity. This is most pronounced not with bipolar, but with Asperger's. Now, Asperger's in the DSM-5 will be eliminated. And one thing that took the APA by surprise was the number of people who wrote in and said, essentially, how dare you take away our identities? They didn't seem to realize that when you tell somebody that this is what you have, you're also telling them, at least sometimes, this is what you are. And that's a function of diagnosis that is very rarely taken into account, I'm afraid.
Now, is that also part of the problem maybe that we have socially, that we sort of think that, well, if it's not a medical illness, if it's not a psychiatric diagnosis, then the person is just like everybody else and has to be treated in this kind of normal, conformist way, that there's a lack of language here, that psychiatry kind of steps in to give an official, authoritative-sounding language to something?
Yeah, we have impoverished ways of understanding difference. And illness has come to be one of our favorite ways to understand difference. And illness gives us some advantages. It turns difference to advantage in the sense that if you have a disease, then what you have is a ticket to social resources. And I don't mean that in a cynical way. That's a good thing. I mean, it's a strange way to distribute social resources, but at least sympathy, money, treatment, research, all get distributed to people whose differences can be understood as diseases.
We're speaking with Gary Greenberg. Gary is a therapist and author. He's a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, and he's written for Rolling Stone, The New Yorker, and The New York Times. He is the author of Manufacturing Depression, and his new book is called The Book of Woe, The DSM and the Unmaking of Psychiatry. This is a huge issue because of the growth in the disability benefits, for example. And there's a kind of either or. Either you are expected to be 100% functional in society, or you fit this disease disability criteria. And we see it in special needs programs, kids getting diagnosed as autistic because they have access to certain kinds of resources. And there's a huge, huge gain in a sense. There's a sort of a social benefit in a very twisted kind of way to getting a diagnosis now. And I think a lot of it ties directly into poverty issues. What do you make of that? How do we navigate that? If we are critiquing the DSM and questioning its scientific validity, how do we sort of deal with this broader issue of access to resources and the ways in which we actually support people who have differences that do need different kinds of support?
Well, I think that the gatekeeping aspect of medicine, which is what you're talking about, is I don't have any way of solving that problem, but I can make a couple of observations. First of all, the whole question probably becomes much more fraught and complicated because we have a for-profit healthcare system. If we didn't have a for-profit healthcare system, I think this would be easier because one incentive that would be taken away would be obviously the profit motive. The difficulty of opening the gate might be lowered, and therefore the need to establish these binaries might be less. Another thing that I would observe is that, you know, the social resources aren't all material. They're also social in the sense of sympathy and so on. A lot of what people are after is just being accepted and understood. And that is, it's helpful to be able to say, well, I'm not just awkward, I have Asperger's syndrome. rather than saying that, you know, I'm awkward, I get to say I have Asperger's syndrome and this is a neurodiverse world. Well, I think that's okay. I mean, that's better than a person just feeling like they're stupid or worthless. But to let medicine make these determinations is also to invite a number of problems. The first of them, obviously, is the problem of cure. If you call something a disease, then somebody's going to try to cure it. And, you know, increasingly, there are people who are saying, I don't know if I want to be cured. You know, the costs are too high, or I sort of like who I am. And if I can find a community that will accept me as, you know, with my schizophrenia or my Asperger's or whatever it is, then maybe I don't want to take these drugs or take this cure. The second burden that comes with it is the one of having to think of yourself as, no matter how well it's put, no matter how little stigma is attached to it, is having to think of yourself as sick. That has implications. And finally, it gives the people who create the labels too much power. You know, that's the problem we have with the DSM and the American Psychiatric Association. They simply have too much power. They're a private guild. They're basically a corporation, and they own these diseases. They own mental disorders, and I mean it literally. They own the intellectual property that tells us what the mental disorders are and what the criteria are by which they're known. That's a huge public trust, and it's privately held.
It seems that one of the implications of that identity creation that a DSM diagnosis gives you is the sense of like, well, okay, now I don't have responsibility for this. And when someone is really suffering and your life feels really out of control, there is a feeling of like, look, I'm trying as hard as I can. I'm doing the best that I can to continue with school or to get my life together or to be able to work. And for whatever reason, I just can't. And then people don't like that and they don't want to hear that. And so there's a way in which, well, saying I'm sick or I have this biological condition is a way of validating that sense of being out of control and not being responsible for that aspect of one's life. But that creates a whole huge set of other problems, because then you start to have an expectation that you're not capable or an expectation that you're not responsible. And so what do you think about that piece of it, the motivation, I think, that often people have who are suffering to get an explanation that sort of takes the feelings of guilt maybe, or feelings of responsibility, or feelings like this is just my fault and I should do something about it on my own?
Well, I think there's plenty of people out there who are motivated to game the system. I don't think that's unfair to say that some people who are seeking treatment, disability, special treatments in some way, accommodations at work, at school, are just trying to game the system.
Well, sure, it's a tough life out there in the United States, especially if you don't have very much money. So yeah, people are getting by however they can get by. I think that there is some truth in that, yeah.
Yeah, I think as times get harder, more people seek disabilities. Not only because it's a way to get a little bit of money, but also because whatever disadvantages you have become much more pronounced as the economic life becomes more difficult to pursue. So I think that's part of what's happening. I think another thing that's going on with that whole conundrum is that personal responsibility may not be all that it's cracked up to be. Or to put that another way, it's subversive to suggest that a person doesn't take personal responsibility for their lives. We have a system that depends on everybody taking responsibility for their lives, but the definition of how you do that is pretty narrow. And there are people who, for various reasons, whether it's because of their constitution, their temperament, their experience, their politics, their whatever, don't want to get with that program. And I think there's a huge fear out there about people who don't take responsibility. That's what happens, as you said, that's what happens with these labels. Some people worry that what they mean is that a person has stopped taking responsibility for their lives. I think that worry is overrated, and I think that it has more to do with a fear that society falls apart. This society falls apart if everybody isn't out there, you know, every man for himself and God against all.
So you think there's a deep connection between this culture of individualism and competition and capitalism and the rise of the power of the DSM?
Yes, I think you've just said it much better than I have. That's exactly right.
So how is it a uniquely American thing?
And I didn't do this in my book. This is a book somebody still has to write. But if you look at the DSM not as a selection of mental illnesses, but rather as a manual that tells us who we're supposed to be, or at least tells us who we're not supposed to be. Or, if you, or to put it briefly, if you look at it as a sort of a moral text, then I think what you find is that behind it, the pathologies that it describes are generally pathologies that occur when people are not able to get with the fundamental assumptions of our society. So, for example, major depression. Well, 20% of Americans are going to have major depression at some point in their lives, according to the recent statistics. That's one in five people. What does that mean? I mean, is it one thing it could mean is that depression is like the common cold. It's very common. But, you know, we don't worry very much about colds. And we used to have doctors yanking out our tonsils all the time because people got cold, but they realized that was a stupid thing to do. So now it's just you take it as part of life. But in a society that's devoted to the pursuit of happiness, the idea that people would be unhappy for a prolonged period, well, that all of a sudden begins to look like, well, maybe there's some kind of demand. Maybe it's oppressive to require people to be happy all the time. Or to put it another way, to suggest that when you're not happy, and if your unhappiness persists for more than 2 weeks, then chances are you have a medical illness. That's an expression of sort of intolerance for unhappiness, or to put it another way, it's an expression of the way in which we value optimism in this particular society. And obviously, optimism is tied to buying things. The index that tells us how our economy is going is the index of consumer confidence. If you don't have confidence, then you don't spend money.
Isn't there a really fast-growing psychology of happiness, an attempt to kind of understand what it is that makes people happy so we can become more happy?
And it's totally nauseating. I wrote an article about this for Harper's Magazine in, I believe, 2009. And it's people who are privileged and wealthy, who have decided what human flourishing is and are figuring out how to help us, you know, reach it. And all you need to know about this is that it's led by Martin Seligman, who made his name in psychology by torturing dogs. He discovered that if you shock dogs randomly, as opposed to shock them for a particular reason, they give up. And he called that learned helplessness. And that made his career. And now what Marty Seligman is doing is he's selling the army a program based on his notions of human flourishing that is designed to inoculate soldiers against PTSD so that they will be able to go into war and be exposed to horror and not develop PTSD. Now, on the one hand, that's a very nice thing because we don't want people to have PTSD, but it would seem to me the obvious solution to that problem is not to send them to the war in the first place. And the idea of people who will be exposed to the horrors of war and not be traumatized is frightening. And that, you know, I don't mean to oversimplify or tar everybody with the same brush, but that I think is as much as you need to know about this human flourishing thing. It's obviously an ideological battle to help people get with the program.
As a headline, hey, let's make everybody happy. Let's believe in happiness. How do we maximize happiness? It sort of has this kind of common sense appeal until you start to think about it a little bit more and realize actually there's more to life. There's like caring and there's the environment and there's meaningful work and there's contributing to each other and supporting each other. And happiness hasn't really been the foundation of many world religions or many moral systems as being the highest value. It's been something, there's something much deeper.
Yes, and to be fair to the advocates of happiness psychology or human flourishing, they do take that into account. They have a definition of the good life. And it does involve being involved with others, and it does involve expanding your mind. It's not simply mindless optimism. However, it still has this whole overlay of nothing should really throw you off your path. You should be resilient. And the fact of the matter is that we're faced with problems like global warming, that if we don't get knocked off our path, we're not going to address them. Hurricane Sandy, which happened out here in the east and devastated the entire Atlantic seaboard, knocked people off their path, and it may actually get them to do something. To be resilient to something like that runs the risk of making people not able to care enough to change what they're doing.
So the DSM, the Bible of Psychiatry, really isn't a scientific objective document. It's, you're saying it's more of a moral text. It's become, and maybe in the absence of the dominance of the church, we've turned to science and we turn to medicine to give us sort of like a sense of what it is to be human. But really, it's making a moral judgment. It's like smuggling in moral values in the claim of science and objectivity.
Yes, that's exactly right. It's not only a text that people might read and say, okay, here's one profession's idea of what the good life is. It's a text that actually allows people to enforce their idea of what the good life is, and that's where it becomes problematic.